I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. Immigration law is at the forefront in the halls of Congress and in Kansas. A new state statute in Kansas requires proof of citizenship before voting in an election for the first time. A similar law in Arizona was just struck down. This hour, Chris Kobach, known for crafting immigration law, and Alvaro Vargas Llosa, author of a new book on immigration, join us to discuss policy and reform. Plus, our next installment of 90 Mile View with a local take on immigration reform. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. The U.S. Senate is in the midst of a weeks-long debate over an immigration bill pieced together by the so-called Gang of Eight, a bipartisan group seeking to pass comprehensive immigration reform. In fact, the bill would be the first major immigration overhaul since President Ronald Reagan backed amnesty for illegal immigrants in 1986. Today, we'll talk about the debate and big questions about border security that appear to be at the heart of it. We'll also talk about a series of immigration myths like this one. There are more immigrants than ever. With us today, Chris Kobach is the Kansas Secretary of State and has long advocated tougher policies toward illegal immigration. Chris, nice to have you.
Great to be with you, Steve.
Also with us is Alvaro Vargas Llosa. He's author of Global Crossings, Immigration, Civilization, and America. He is senior fellow at the Independent Institute and has been a nationally syndicated columnist for the Washington Post Writers Group. Llosa joins us this morning from the NPR studios in Washington. And Alvaro, nice to have you. Good morning to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's set the table here, Alvaro. How did this country morph from, you know, one that celebrated its status as a nation of immigrants to one that's now skeptical and sometimes very critical of the U.S. taking in more foreigners?
Well, that's a myth also. There's always been, of course, a part of America that embraced immigration, clearly, but there's always been a part of America that was very hostile to immigration. I go into that in a lot of detail in the book. I mean, the Irish, the Poles, even the Germans, of course, the Italians, the Jews, and certainly the Asians, Japanese and Chinese, even in the 19th century as well as in the 20th century. All of these different groups met a lot of resistance at the time. Of course, as time went by, people looked back, and retrospectively, they embraced all those immigrant waves, just as one day they will look back on this era and embrace Mexican and Central American and Latin American immigration and Filipino immigration and so on and so forth.
You know, Chris, you're seen by some as the face of the Republican Party's eagerness to crack down on illegal immigration. What's your take on all this?
Well, I disagree slightly with what Alvaro just said. He's right about attitudes toward legal immigration. If you look at survey data over the last 50 years, the public attitudes toward more legal immigration are pretty consistent. The public is split. You have, you know, a little over half the public skeptical of more legal immigration because they're afraid of wage depression and the like. And then you have just under half wanting more legal immigration. What has changed, where I disagree with Alvaro, and this is completely different from previous waves of immigration, is now we have illegal immigration in the mix, large numbers of it, and that is what prompts most Americans. I think many Americans, probably the majority, take the attitude I have of legal immigration is just fine, but illegal immigration is not okay because we cannot control illegal immigration. We can't ensure that it meets our national interests. And then the second difference today is the welfare state. As Milton Friedman famously said, it's just obvious. You can't have open immigration and the welfare state. Think about that.
Alvaro, how do you respond to what Chris just said? Because he's made that point repeatedly, you know, over recent months. What do you say to that?
Well, first of all, the evidence about hostility to previous waves of immigrants is there. I go into it in a lot of detail. I have quotes from all sorts of politicians and journalists at the time. And just look at the laws. I mean, the laws that were passed against the Japanese in the late 19th century and early 20th century, the restrictions on the Chinese at the time of the gold rush in the 19th century. And again, different attempts at reform placed different types of restrictions this time. The issue of the welfare state is a fascinating one. I would say two things. First, immigrants are not responsible for the fact that the government spending has grown by a factor of 50 in the last century. U.S. politicians are to blame for that. And second, it's really important to take into account the fact that immigrants contribute a lot more than they take out of the system. Just this week, we had the Congressional Budget Office coming up with interesting figures about the impact on the reduction of the fiscal deficit if immigrants were legalized. I also quote other studies, one in particular, which has become pretty much a standard by the National Research Council a few years ago, and that has been updated. And they come up with a figure that basically has the net present value of all the costs and all the contributions if we take into account the next 50 years, because you know immigrants are very young. If they're legalized, they'll be right. working presumably for another 50 years. And the net present value is a cost of just one-off cost of $5,000. You balance that out against the contribution to the economy in terms of productivity and the overall benefit, I mean, far outweighs the cost.
He says it's going to outweigh it. It's going to pay for itself, Chris.
Well, we've got to get more specific than Alvaro is getting. Yes, the Congressional Budget Office said that it's but they were only looking at federal spending. It's roughly a wash. But the highest price tag for illegal immigration is paid by state and local governments. And so we've always known that at the federal level, if you only isolate federal spending, it's not going to be that big of an impact. But the Heritage Foundation has calculated the cost of state and local deficits created by illegal immigration, giving an amnesty.
Through welfare spending, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, welfare and other public benefits. Yeah. It depends on how you define it, but public benefits would also include education, of course. Mm-hmm. And they have concluded that it's a $6.3 trillion net deficit over the lifetime of the illegal aliens. If you look at the individual household, the average illegal alien household with children consumes $19,588 more per year in government services than they pay in taxes. And this is not really a function of necessarily where the aliens come from or even their illegality. It's a function of the fact that they are generally undereducated and poor. The vast majority of illegal aliens, a huge percentage, have less than a high school education. So they're earning jobs. They're in jobs earning very little income. And then we have such a generous welfare state that they end up pulling more out of the system than they contribute in taxes. So he's right. I mean, immigration, legal immigration, if it is carefully, if we have high income earners, science, technology, people with master's degrees and higher, absolutely it increases our wealth and our fiscal condition. But if you bring in lots of poor people who are going to take out more than they contribute to our welfare state, then we go further into the red.
Alvaro, Chris Kobach's making the point the rub comes in with state government spending. Do you buy that?
No. Immigrants, including illegal immigrants, pay a lot of the local and state taxes for everything from real estate to gas, even Social Security. I guess the last study I saw by the government indicated about $7 billion in taxes by illegal immigrants in terms of Social Security. That Heritage study has been totally debunked by conservatives themselves. It makes several mistakes. It doesn't take into account the contribution to the productive economy, and that's a huge part of this. It doesn't take into account the fact that many of the children they're counting as illegal immigrants are children of at least one legal parent. And it doesn't take into account another very important fact, because they place a lot of emphasis on this notion of school dropouts. But the number of American, of native school dropouts is three times larger than that of immigrants. So if that's really the issue, then we need a campaign to modify that situation and have Americans complete their high school years. Yep. If the issue is poverty, again, the number of poor Americans is about three times larger than the number of poor immigrants. Yeah. And I think it's also important to understand what you cannot see is sometimes more important than what you can see. one of the most prominent critics of immigration, a Harvard professor called George Borges, came up with this figure. He said immigrants contribute about $22 billion to the economy. What we say is we updated the figures. We say that if that's true, then it's at least $36 billion today. If you legalize them, that will multiply by two or three. So we're talking about almost $100 billion a year over a period of 10 years, about $1 trillion. You have to take that into account when you're calculating what they cost and what they benefit. And that you cannot see today, of course.
Chris, I'm going to go back to the Heritage study. Has it been debunked or has it not been?
No, it has not been. What Alvaro said about it regarding the productive economic value is correct. The Heritage study is not looking at the total economic impact of illegal aliens being legalized. It's looking just at the fiscal impact, only the costs of government services. So, yes, he could make the argument, and many people have argued both sides. If you look at the broader economic impact, the spending and the buying that illegal aliens do once they're legalized, yeah, that's debatable. But the fiscal part is not debatable. If you look at the state and local and federal altogether, we're $6.3 trillion a whole. One other point, he's right. You do increase the productive size of your economy whenever you bring in more people. That's just basic economics.
Right.
You have more people in the country, you therefore have more production. However, that's not where the economist should stop. You then have to ask, okay, but what's the per capita GDP? Are we bringing in more poor people, and are we reducing our average income in this country, and are we increasing the burden on the welfare state? We're already so far in the red as a country, we have to be very careful about what we do for our welfare state. We are a very generous nation, and we should be, but we can't just say, okay, come on in, world. We don't care what your income is. We'll just pay for your welfare. We'll pay for your public education. Because we American taxpayers are footing the bill, and we have to be responsible toward our immigration policy and think about those numbers.
I want to move on to the Gang of Eight's bipartisan plan for reforming immigration. This comprehensive measure the Senate is now discussing, including a lot of conversation about how to tighten border security to ease the problem that Secretary Kobach was just talking about. If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about immigration reform in this country, this big bill before the U.S. Senate. Chris Kobach, the Kansas Secretary of State, is with us. Also here is Alvaro Vargas Llosa. He's author of Global Crossings, Immigration, Civilization, and America. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. If you like or don't like something that's said here today, now's your chance to call in. Again, 816-235-2888. Don't wait until after the show. If you're concerned about what you're hearing either way, call us now. You can also email us at uptodate@kcur.org or tweet us at @KCURUptodate. Alvaro, the pendulum appears to be swinging in favor of, you know, this type of comprehensive reform the Senate's now considering. Just yesterday, I was struck. Gallup reported that a majority of Americans would vote for each of six different policy changes that Congress is now considering as part of a comprehensive immigration reform bill. How surprised were you by that?
Well, I mean, it one day it looks as if it's going to pass. One day it looks as if it's going to be very tough.
Yes,
one day
right.
It looks as if Republicans are going to help. One day it looks as if they're not going to help. So I'm really not 100% clear on what's going to happen. What I do think is that there is a current of opinion within the Republican Party. It's probably a minority at this point, but a significant minority that's really helping. And I think that ultimately they're going to carry the day. My only worry is that they will have to maybe accept a number of amendments that may hurt the essence of this. And of course, the other really important issue is the House, where I think skepticism is much broader. And again, I think they may alter the bill ultimately in such a way that the beneficial aspects of it may be hurt. And there are other aspects in terms of caps for particular categories of immigrants that I think will be even tightened even further, which I again think it'll be a mistake because it'll repeat the mistake of the 1986 amnesty.
Alvaro, what's the toughest nut for Congress to crack when it comes to trying to pass this bill? Where does the issue come into the sharpest relief here?
Well, the border security, there's this notion that the bill doesn't take that into account. If you read the bill, I'm probably one of the few people in the country who's taken the trouble to read it.
You've done it.
It believe me, it's quite boring and long. But border security is a huge chunk of it. I mean, the whole first title. It's divided into four titles. I mean, it's a huge part of it. They're throwing even more money at this. They're creating a whole new bureaucratic entity at this. They're placing a lot of responsibility on the shoulders of that entity. They will ultimately have the last word on this. They're placing a condition that's very, very tough for people to move. Once they move from the illegal status to temporary residence, if they want to move to permanent residence, to green card status, they will need to prove that there's a 90% rate of success in terms of apprehensions at the border. And all of that is part of this bill. And I think very few people are aware of that in the country at large. So there's this myth that it doesn't take care of border security at all.
Yeah, Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, still saying that may be the crunch point of this measure. Chris Kobach, what do you think is the prospects for this bill going forward?
Well, let me respond to what Alvaro just said. I, too, have read it as an attorney who litigates these issues all the time. I was asked to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee, which I did in April. Sure, the first section of the bill talks about enforcement, but let's be a little more specific. Let's look at what it exactly says. It says we're going to devote some more money toward enforcement, toward the agencies that enforce the laws. But then what does it do specifically? There's all this talk about, oh, there's real enforcement triggers. Well, there's two triggers. The first one is this. The amnesty begins when the Department of Homeland Security submits a piece of paper to Congress saying what their strategy is for the future. That's nothing. They have pieces of paper stating their strategies already written out. Then the amnesty begins. Oh, what about the 90% trigger? Oh, sure, there's a 90% provision in the bill, but it says this.
90% meaning what?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It says in three of the nine border sectors, the ones we think are the heaviest traveled, we need to catch 90% of the illegal aliens attempting to enter. Okay, well, 90% is a fraction. What is the numerator? What is the denominator? The denominator is all of the people trying to enter. Well, we don't know what the denominator is. Our Border Patrol has said we can't calculate that because we have no idea. If we knew everybody who was coming in, if there was a little turnstile, then we would be able to.
So when it comes to border security then, Chris, what needs to be in there that would satisfy you and folks like Marco Rubio from Florida?
Okay, I'll get to that, but let me finish the 90% point. So it's a fiction. They just say they have Homeland Security declare at some point, oh, yeah, we think we've got 90% in these three sectors. A, they can't calculate it, and B, if they could, it would just be because the illegal aliens were going to the other six sectors. So it's ridiculous. Well, what happens if they fail to meet that 90%? I'll tell you what happens. The bill says a commission is formed, and a commission will tell DHS how to better spend their money. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
That's not that's not any serious consequence.
So that's what Marco Rubio is concerned about, it sounds like.
Well, and that's what the Republicans are concerned about. That's what Senator Grassley offered an amendment last week, I guess it was, beginning of the week, basically trying to replace those meaningless triggers with some real border enforcement.
Such as,
and here's where I would answer your question specifically, such as let's finish the 700 miles of fencing that was promised in October of 2006 in a bill that was passed right before the election and never completed.
How far along are we with that?
I think we're somewhere between 40 and 50 miles, and now it's virtually stopped.
50 miles short, you're saying?
No. We've only done 40 or 50 miles. And then the administration has said, well, we think we can satisfy that with a virtual fence, meaning we'll just try to look at the border more carefully. So that Grassley said, let's replace those meaningless so-called triggers with some real benchmarks and then say the amnesty starts after we achieve these things. That was voted down by the Democrat leadership in the Senate. So that gets to where I think the political future of this bill is. If the Democrat leadership continues to say, no, we're not going to do anything reasonable to make the border security elements of this bill real, then it's going to fail because you're going to see Republicans defecting in large numbers because they're going to say, look, we're going to be – it's just like Lucy and Charlie Brown in the football. You made us kick the football in 1986 and there was nothing done about border security and here you're trying to do it to us again. And you're already seeing Republicans say that already. If there's no border security, real border security in this bill, we're getting out because there is no real border security in the text of S-7044 as it was written.
But Alvaro, I get the sense that sort of one of the undercurrents here – and again, I'm always guilty of looking at the world through the prism of politics, which is what I do for a living – but there's this undercurrent of real pressure on the GOP to pass something here because so many Republicans feel they need to get right with Latino voters. How do you see that dynamic playing out here?
Well, I mean, there's a, I guess, a contradictory dynamic. I mean, one is the one that just we just heard from Chris. I mean, clearly there's a current of opinion in the Republican Party that, that simply wants this to be about border security, and that's it. And then we will talk about the possibility of legalization and other issues related to this. Unfortunately, that's not a realistic objective. I think that eventually you'll find out that there's no way to prevent people from coming in unless you seal off the borders completely, which means creating a sort of fortress America that's detached from the rest of the world. It's a completely unrealistic universe. Even the Soviet Union was not able to prevent people from getting out. I also think that the other problem here is that we're missing a very essential point. That's not the only border in the United States. And if, by chance, you were able to seal off completely the border with Mexico, you would find soon that immigrants would find ways to get around that and come in through, I don't know, Canada or the two coasts or whatever. So eventually you would end up with a fortress America. The best way to ensure that people use legal channels, and nobody wants people to use illegal channels. We're all in favor of the rule of law. People come here desperate for the rule of law, is to connect the law to reality. If the law reflects reality, if you let the market dynamics of demand and supply work relatively freely, you will realize that people use legal channels. You will not get suddenly 300, 400 million people walking across the border into the United States. You will get pretty much the numbers you've had in the past, because the fact that you have 12 million people in the shadows essentially means that people, whoever wanted to get in, was able to get in. And those were the numbers you got. And those were not unreasonable numbers, because the proportion of immigrants today in relation to the rest of the population is about the same as it was in the periods of greatest immigration into the United States at the end of the 19th century and early 20th century, when it was legal.
Huh. Just a short answer to this, Chris. You know, is a border fence a panacea here?
A border fence is just one of several things we need to do. I was just offering that as an example, because it's a specific amendment. We also need to have E-Verify mandatory for all businesses immediately. This bill doesn't do that. It actually gradually replaces E-Verify with something else to be determined.
This was supposed to be a comprehensive bill.
Yeah. There's so many. This bill is a cobbled together bunch of previous bills that were before Congress. It is much more liberal, more permissive toward illegal immigration than the 2007 amnesty that was rejected. The drafters of this bill were very sloppy. If they were smart about it, they would have done some real things for enforcement. They would have made E-Verify mandatory immediately. They would have some specific miles of border fencing. And Alvaro's right. The border fence is not the only thing you do.
Yeah.
It would have also stepped up cooperation with state and local law enforcement. In fact, this bill cuts back cooperation with state and local law enforcement, delays a nationalization of E-Verify, and it guts border enforcement. Let me rephrase that. It guts enforcement of our immigration laws in many real ways. And that's why once you start looking at the bill, you read it, you think, wait, this hurts enforcement. Let me give you one more quick example. This bill gives amnesty to certain illegal aliens who've already been deported. It allows them to come back to the United States and claim the amnesty.
How so?
It is outrageous. It's right in the bill. It says if you meet certain criteria, you can come back in. If you have family members in the United States, come on back in.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up Today, and you'll be shocked to know we have lots of phone calls, lots of email here as we discuss immigration reform with Chris Kobach and Alvaro Vargas-Llosa. Alvaro, yeah, go ahead. Briefly, please.
About E-Verify, if I read correctly, this actually reinforces E-Verify. I'm not sure it's a great idea, because government studies indicate there's a lot of fraud, and not only about 4% of those who are approved shouldn't be approved, but then you have an absurd situation in which about 1% to 2% of those who were not approved, in other words, legitimate U.S. citizens seeking work are
numbers,
not allowed not to be approved.
I'd be happy to respond to that. I know all the numbers are verified. That's not correct.
One second, please. I also think that places a burden on U.S. business interests. I mean, the last thing as a conservative you should want is more regulation and making it harder for people to start businesses and open businesses. I mean, certainly the move should be away from over-regulation in a country where there is simply too much regulation already.
Let me read an email here from Hillary, who writes us this at UpToDate@KCUR.org. I wonder perhaps if part of the issue here is the difference between playing the short game and playing the long game, she writes. Several recent studies have shown that the children of Hispanic immigrants are succeeding, sometimes even more so than their white American counterparts. Even if there is an upfront cost for the immigrants, doesn't the benefit of adding their children to our future economy outweigh it? Chris?
Well, I mean, you know, in theory, you could say that, yeah, the second generation is going to be super performing educationally and super performing economically and will therefore lift our welfare state and lift our fiscal situation out of the hole we're in. But, I think that's entirely – you're projecting into the future and it's a guess, but I don't think we can rely on that. And you have to deal with the fiscal reality we're in right now, where if you bring in large numbers of people – who have less than a high school education, you know, the world's poor. Remember, it's not the nation's high-tech master's degree, doctoral degree people who are immigrating illegally. If you bring in these individuals and give them legal status, they will end up taking far more out of our welfare state than they put in. And we just have to recognize that that's the difference since the middle of the 1960s and all prior waves of illegal immigration. We now have to consider the fact that the American taxpayers are footing the bill. And so let's be smart about it. That's why I think most Americans are okay with legal immigration, because we can decide, okay, how many do we need? How many will put too much of a burden on our welfare state? What are the correct visa categories that should come in? We can gauge it to our national interests. I'm all for legal immigration because it fits our national interests. But illegal immigration, by definition, does not conform to our national interests, and it ends up putting us further and further in the fiscal hole.
Alvaro, chime in here.
Well, the reason we get low-skilled immigration here, and Europeans have been getting a lot of low-skilled immigration in the last few decades, is because the economy desperately needed it. The way this started was basically people who were building railroads in the United States went to Mexico to bring in Mexican workers. Until then, they had been using Japanese workers, and then they substituted Mexican workers for them. In the 40s and 50s, you had the Bracero program, a guest worker program, and incidentally, that was a period in which illegal immigration was very, very, very low because of that guest worker program. Again, this was agriculture interest in the United States needing and wanting and getting workers from overseas. The same happened in Europe. Germany had to sign a treaty with Turkey to bring in Turks into Germany as low-skilled workers, and France did the same with Algeria, and Spain did the same with Morocco. It's just a fact of the modern economy that you still need a certain amount of low-skilled, mechanized labor that is going to be part of the modern economy, even if it's a high-tech economy. But I do agree with Chris on one thing. High-skilled immigration is very important. Unfortunately, the kinds of caps and ceilings we've had in the last few years have been very unrealistic. I mean, it got to a point, I remember just before the bursting of the bubble with the booming economy, when the quota for H-1B visas for high-skilled immigrants would be exhausted literally on day one. I mean, the day the applications began to be accepted, that same day, the whole quota would be exhausted. So clearly that was unrealistic. In this bill, there's an effort to raise those ceilings. Unfortunately, I still think those caps are a little unrealistic. Just prognosticating the future, anticipating the future so specifically is always going to be risky. But again, it's a move in the right direction. The contribution of high-skilled immigrants has been colossal. About one in four Nobel Prize winners in the last century, one in three doctorates in engineering and technology and science. They've opened so many businesses, created so many hundreds and hundreds of thousands of jobs. So clearly you want a lot of high-skilled immigrants as well.
That's the voice of Alvaro Vargas Llosa. He's the author of Global Crossings. Chris Kobach is also here. Let's grab some phone calls before a break. Mike from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Hello. Let me mention, I agree completely that you, pardon me, I'm a liberal, and I agree completely, you don't pass a law unless you got border security, because all that happens when you give amnesty to the people that are in here now. You know, if I was in line, I'd get in there and come over. So anyways, but here's my question I was trying to get to, and
yeah.
I don't know if it's important anyways. on Chris Kobach, on the Supreme Court in their reversal of Arizona, I kind of think you were very much involved in writing that legislation. And my question is, what did they really reverse that you're trying to propose in other states?
Let me just point out that what Mike's talking about is the U.S. Supreme Court ruling this week that concluded that Arizona cannot require voters to document their citizenship before allowing them to cast ballots in federal elections, Chris.
I thought Mike was talking about the SB 1070, but yeah, I'll talk about both. Supreme Court this week ruled that Arizona's Prop 200, which says that a voter registration application will be rejected unless it's accompanied by proof of citizenship. They ruled that that is – it's a very technical opinion. But with the federal registration form, that's not permissible. I did not write that law. That was drafted in 2003 or 2004.
Before you became involved in Arizona.
Yeah, I didn't get involved with Arizona until 2007. And in Kansas, we have a similar law, but ours – we drafted it while the Arizona law was already in litigation. We knew about the problems with the Arizona law, so we drafted ours differently in Kansas. Ours accepts the federal form, whereas Arizona rejected the federal form if not accompanied by proof of citizenship. What I think Mike may have been asking about was the SB 1070 bill that was passed in 2010. That was the one that was so much in the news in the last few years. I did help Arizona draft
about police
that.
Officers having a right to stop someone just on the suspicion that they might be an illegal immigrant.
Well, no, they stop someone because of some other state or local violation, speeding or whatever. And the question then, what the bill authorizes and orders police to do is to follow up if they develop reasonable suspicion that the person they're giving a speeding ticket to is illegally in the United States, then they should contact the federal government from their squad car. You can do this. There's a system set up. And then verify if that person is actually legally in the country or not. The Supreme Court had a split decision on SB 1070. That provision about how the arrest protocols work, that was sustained, upheld by the Supreme Court. There were three minor provisions concerning making soliciting work as an illegal alien a crime, concerning a registration scheme that Arizona would have to match the federal scheme, and concerning another aspect of warrantless arrest authority. Though very minor ones that would not have been in play, those were struck down by the divided court. Mm-hmm. I disagree with the court on those three, but the main one, the arrest protocols, were upheld by the court. So, you know, it's a split decision. The big one was upheld. Three small ones were struck down.
And going back to the ruling this week about voting and voting rights and that kind of thing, you're confident that the Kansas law is going to be okay?
Yes, I am, because
it
was already – the Arizona litigation has been going on since 2005, I think. And so the Arizona case was already in the Ninth Circuit. And so when we drafted the Kansas law, we said, okay, let's look at what they're claiming about the Arizona law. Let's do ours differently. And so we drafted ours specifically to avoid the challenge that was being made against Arizona. So I think we're going to be fine.
The Wichita Eagle's out today with a really tough editorial about you, Chris. And the editorial says this in part, of course, you predicted that all the conservative-leaning members of the U.S. Supreme Court would support Arizona's voter registration law, which didn't happen. And he said that the Arizona immigration law that he helped write would pass constitutional muster, but that didn't happen. And he was certain that the courts would toss out in-state tuition laws for immigrants, which also didn't happen. Kobach is wrong a lot, and he is likely wrong again.
Well, the Wichita Eagle editorial board, you know, it's easy to make – you got to be specific. Okay. The SB 1070 case, that was a divided opinion. Yes, I was incorrect that the three minor provisions would be upheld by the court, but the big one, the central provision, was upheld. Regarding the Arizona case that was decided this week, yeah, I thought it would probably go 5-4 in favor of Arizona. But to be careful, we in Kansas drafted a law that takes the provision that's being challenged in Arizona. We do the exact opposite. We accept the federal form and use it.
And the ACLU, just to point out, might challenge the law nonetheless.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you can never predict what they're going to do. And then as far as in-state tuition, the Wichita Eagle's flat out wrong. The substance of an in-state tuition law has never been challenged in federal court. There was an attempt, which I was involved in 2004. It got thrown out on standing, meaning that the plaintiffs in that case did not have the ability to bring the legal claim because they weren't personally injured enough. So the court never got to the question of whether the in-state tuition law in Kansas was legal or not. So for the Wichita Eagle to say, oh, he was wrong, no, the court didn't even reach a decision on it.
All right.
You know, it's this sort of superficial, sloppy journalism, which I'm happy to say, Steve, you don't engage and you get to the details. But a lot of people write these editorials and they have no idea. They're not being specific. You got to be specific if you're going to be fair.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll get to some myths about immigration. We'll get to the big protest in Chris Kobach's front yard over the weekend. We'll take your questions, too, from Artemis, Elizabeth, Mary, and Elaine. I hope we can get to y'all. Again, our number 816-233. 855-2888. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversation about First Lady Betty Ford or our discussion about reducing poverty, you can find it at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, Shiver Me Timbers and Raise the Jolly Roger, we'll check out the story of some real pirates on the high seas, look at the art of vintage cars with some racing legends, and we'll get our weekend to-do list from Brian McTavish. This hour, we're talking about immigration reform, the big bill before the U.S. Senate. Chris Kobach is here. He's the Kansas Secretary of State. Also here, Alvaro Vargas Llosa. He's author of Global Crossings, Immigration, Civilization, and America. Let's grab some more calls. Folks have been waiting very patiently here. Artemis from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Okay. I'm sorry. A lot of things have come up since my original call. So let me just say very briefly that Republicans need to get right with women, not give power over Americans to the descendants of the Spanish conquistadors and the people who willingly left this land thousands of years ago. But here's what I'd like to get you to comment on. 40% of the current or immigrants for the last 23 years have been in highly educated. That's the myth. But in fact, we bring in hundreds of thousands into the country, many as foreign students every year, and graduate three times as many as we have jobs for every year in science, technology, engineering, math. We don't need more high-skilled workers. We've got too many, and we're throwing people out of jobs. We're throwing Americans out of jobs because of nepotism and erroneously named minority advantages, which give the foreigners job preferences. Please comment on that.
Yeah, Artemis, thank you. And Alvaro, why don't you weigh in here in her point about do we need more high-skilled workers, as I thought I heard you say, or do we not?
Well, if the quota for high-skilled workers used to be before this bill, it still is, I guess, the case, is exhausted on day one. As soon as applications are allowed, that quota is exhausted, which means clearly that there's a higher demand for them than the system currently allows. Another way to look at this is just look at all the corporations in America that are crying for more high-skilled immigrants. I mean, everything from Microsoft to Facebook, all of these people have been at the forefront of the fight for allowing a greater number of high-skilled workers. I don't think there's a lot of debate about
them,
that.
You're saying. Even, they want them.
They want them. Even critics of immigration in the Republican Party, I think, accept this. And this bill includes a very interesting provision about this. I still think those caps, those ceilings, are probably going to be overtaken by reality at some point. But there's at least an improvement there. And clearly, Republicans are not making a lot of fuss about that aspect of the bill. So I think at least we have a growing consensus that high-skilled immigration is a great thing for America.
Okay, Chris?
Well, I'll agree with Alvaro that he is right that the supply of high-skilled visas is immediately consumed on the first day or the first week. It is very fast. However, that does not disprove Artemis's point. Her point was there are large numbers of unemployed U.S. citizen programmers and other high-tech, you know, people who've been trained in high-tech jobs just coming out of college and unable to find work. And in fact, both statements are true. What that means is that there are a large number of people who want to come to work in the United States in high-tech jobs, and they do fill up those visa slots very quickly. But at the same time, there are the unemployment numbers are very high among recently graduating high-tech college graduates and advanced degree graduates in America.
If that's the case, then why is Facebook sort of clamoring for more high-tech workers, as Alvaro just said? What's going on there?
I don't know. I don't have the statistics to look exactly at it, so I'm not sure what the point is. But it is a really weird phenomenon because there are legitimate claims by legitimately unemployed U.S. students who have just gotten their master's degree in high-tech jobs, and they can't get a job. Yet at the same time, you do have organizations like Facebook saying, we can't get the workers we want. So maybe there's a mismatch between the way they've been trained. But strangely enough, there is a significant amount of unemployment among recently graduated high-tech degree-holding U.S. citizens.
Okay.
So could I weigh in, please?
Quickly, yeah.
Well, I mean, I think it's got to do with the recession or the slow economy, not with, with immigrants. Just look at it this way. I mean, since the Second World War, we've had about 100 million people, 90 million people join the workforce in the United States, baby boomers and women in particular. And there's never been high unemployment on a long-term basis. We've had periods here and there because of recessions, but not because of the effect of the those dozens of millions of people joining the workforce. So clearly the economy is a moving thing. It's not a static, a given animal, so to speak. So I think what you will see is that as we begin to grow again, we will have those people be absorbed by the market and the economy. And the economy can do with them and with even more high-skilled immigrants.
Eve from Lenexa writes in at UpToDate at KCUR, Chris, to challenge one of your comments. She says, Mr. Kobach incorrectly suggests that undocumented immigrants can receive so-called welfare benefits. In fact, she writes, since the 1996 welfare reform law, even legal immigrants are not eligible for several of these social support programs.
She is absolutely right that the 1996 law, found at Title 8, Section if I can remember it here, Title 8, Section 1911 and I think 1921 of that bill.
That's correct.
Prohibits illegal aliens.
Yeah.
It does. It's right on the face of federal law. You can't do it. States can't give them welfare benefits and the feds can't. But she is incorrect in assuming that the states are all following the law. The vast majority of states in America have not done anything to ensure that their welfare benefits are not going to illegal aliens. So as a result, even though the face of the law says you're not supposed to be giving welfare benefits to illegal aliens, the reality is they're getting it. One of the reasons we're confirming that reality, Center for Immigration Studies did a study in April of 2011, found that 71% of illegal alien households take advantage of some form of welfare, not necessarily all forms, chiefly food assistance and Medicaid, so food stamps and things like that. So it's happening. It's happening because the states aren't following federal law.
I guess just goes to show you just how complicated this issue is and how many nuances and subtleties there are that sort of dominate this debate. Tough stuff to get all of our arms around collectively here.
And I just realized it was Section 1611 and 1621.
I was just going to correct you, but you're absolutely right. Yeah. Alvaro, I want to get to one of the myths that you write about in your book. You've written, and Chris, you've talked about these as well. Here's one that so many folks still struggle with, it seems to me. And Alvaro, I want you to address this first. And the myth is this: there are more immigrants than ever, and these immigrants break the mold of previous waves. What about that?
Well, I mean, I suppose Chris would look at it this way. There are more illegals than there have ever been. But I don't think you should look at it that way, because if the law was more realistic, they wouldn't be illegal. They would be documented. What we have here is basically the same proportion we've had historically between the, 1880 or so and 1920, which was a period of very heavy immigration. The proportion of the population that was immigrant was, depending on the exact year, between 13% and 15%. The numbers are about that today, less than 15%, actually closer to 13%. And the average, historical average for the 20th century, the whole of the 20th century, is about 10%. So the proportion is not all that huge. Worldwide, only 3% of the population, 3% is first-generation immigrant, and only 1 in 6 immigrants are illegal. So we're not really talking about a huge proportion, but I guess the terms of the debate, the way in which the debate has been framed, makes a lot of people think we have a disproportionate issue today in relation to, with respect to what went on in the past. That is simply not true.
Samuel Huntington, the late Harvard professor, wrote a book called Who Are We? It was his last book he wrote before he died. And he points out three important differences. One, we've already talked about the large percentage of illegal aliens in the current wave. The second ones are really interesting, though. The second one is the current wave of immigration, legal and illegal, from south of the border is not cutting ties with a home country, in mainly because the immigration is from a neighboring country. And previous waves of immigration, they were coming across an ocean on a ship. You didn't have email. You couldn't call someone on a cell phone back home. So there's not a cutting of ties. The third difference is an interesting one. There's not as much pressure to learn English quickly, because here internally in America, we feel maybe guilty, or we feel like we're not supposed to press people into, you have to learn English, you have to learn it right away. And so those are the differences that Samuel Huntington noted. And he said these are important differences in the current wave. And, you can draw whatever conclusions you want, but those differences are certainly true.
I'll start with the second part, if I could. I totally agree. I mean, there used to be a thing called Americanization in the past, in the first part of the 20th century, where it wasn't so much government policy, it was just general social and cultural attitude in the country. Everything kind of pushed amiably and friendly, and I don't mean it in a different way, immigrants to learn English and become part of the culture very, very quickly. That was, of course, replaced by multiculturalism. And there's a chapter in my book that's very critical of multiculturalism, the idea that we should do social engineering with immigrants and minorities and look at them as these collectivist entities that are somehow, entitled to get all sorts of privileges. I mean, none of that is true. I think we could learn from the period of history in which Americanization created a climate in which people felt they needed to learn English quickly. However, having said that, the pattern of assimilation today is very much the same that it's always been. It's a three-generation pattern. The first generation makes an effort. And indeed, 40% of them, of people who come in, already speak, decent English. But the first generation makes an effort. The second generation is bilingual but speaks English better than Spanish or any other language. And the third generation assimilates completely, doesn't speak the mother tongue, as it were. And they feel so secure in their assimilation that they begin to celebrate, you know, national holidays and all of that, just sentimentally, I guess, symbolically. But it's really the same three-generation pattern we've always had in the country.
We're going to have to leave our debate there. And what a debate it is. Very few topics light up the phone lines here as this one does. Chris Kobach told me on his radio show the same thing often happens. I want to thank Alvaro Vargas Llosa, author of Global Crossings, for his time today. Thanks so much, Alvaro.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Chris Kobach, good to have you, too. Thanks for your
time
today.
My pleasure.